It's the Burt Cohen Show. What a history it's been, what a history it still is. There's dreams and there's nightmares. And one of the ugliest parts of American history is something called the Ku Klux Klan. And is it gone? Well, yes, it is, but maybe it's still there in a way. We're going to be looking at that today on The Burt Cohen Show, talking with the author of a brand new book, Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan. The author is David Cunningham. David Cunningham is an associate professor of sociology at Brandeis University. David Cunningham, thanks so much for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show today. Quite a subject to talk about.
Yes, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, the book looks at how organized vigilantism powerfully and enduringly shapes community landscapes. Klansville, USA provides an opportunity to rethink conventional understandings of the political evolution of the South and nation over the last half century. And I want to start off by reading a quote from an article from March 10th, 2013, an article by Salon by a woman named Ronlyn Dominique. The title of the article is, "I Shook Hands with a Klansman." She says, "I noted the practiced political smile, and I met his eyes. They were not cold or cruel. His suit was traditional, appropriate, even tasteful. My flesh didn't crawl, nor did my gag reflex kick in. If I hadn't known who he was, I might have guessed he was an accountant, someone quite mild. He was so ordinary." I find that very interesting, that sense of normalcy, that these people are not monsters as we might expect. And you say, in writing this book, a respectful engagement with Klan personas and worldviews is crucial to comprehend organized racism and acknowledge sometimes uncomfortable truths. I wonder if you could say more about that, looking at the humanity of these people and using a sociological point of view to write this book.
Sure. The period that I look at, which is in the 1960s, the Klan was effectively a mass movement, and I focus in a place like North Carolina where there were literally more than 10,000 Klan members. And in that sort of environment, the KKK was recruiting people who felt like their way of life was being threatened. So these are people in the white community who really their status is deeply tied into Jim Crow-style segregation. And so the people that they were recruiting were people who owned service stations, who worked at factories, who sometimes were farming for a way of life. But they were really recruiting a cross-section of people in the community. And one of the things that you can look at if you do a profile of their membership is a profile of the Klan's membership does not significantly differ from the overall economic profile of a typical community in the South. And so I was really interested in how that happened and who these people were and exactly the kind of idea that you're presenting here through this quote. One of the most telling things that I think a Klan leader that I've learned a lot about, a guy named Bob Jones, who is the state leader in North Carolina, he was big into providing a public presence for the Klan and putting people out there in their robes with their faces exposed so people knew who they were. And one of his favorite quotes was, "Without our robes on, we look just like people." Right. And it's this idea that the people that they're recruiting are not maniacal, marginal folks, but people who are really deeply tied into the communities where they exist.
Yes, and I wanted to, again, look at it from a sociological perspective, which is so needed, I think. And I wonder if there, and I've talked about the sense of tribe on other shows and how tribes seem to be so important throughout the history of the world. Does not a sense of racial solidarity and collective identity pervade a lot of human culture and history? And they talked of the Klan book that you wrote talks about their sense of the perceived need for collective identity and something like what they called authentic whiteness. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you see is in a setting where people feel threatened, that their way of life is threatened, what you tend to see are the boundaries that create people's identities tend to strengthen. So people really do pull into this tribe-like dynamic. So in a civil rights context in the South, the idea of being white actually took on a whole new importance. It was much more something that could be mobilized around in a way that might have been taken for granted in earlier years, where segregation was just a way of life and a given. So we certainly do see the sense of collective identity strengthening under conditions of threat. And you mentioned the KKK had this whole idea of authentic whiteness, and really what that was creating a sense of identity that went beyond race. It wasn't enough just to be phenotypically white in a physiological racial sense, but also to be authentically white, you had to align with principles of Klan-style whiteness, which affirmed segregation, it affirmed racial separation, it affirmed white supremacy, so the superiority of the white race. So there are people who might have fit physically into most people's categories of whiteness, but the Klan rejected them. And this ranged anything from Jews and people who weren't seen as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant version of white, but also aligned with people who were just overly liberal politically, and they were seen as inauthentic, and they were sort of expelled from that circle of identity.
So it's some identity of a certain specific cultural identity, really, which it seems to me is something that, as you said, existed for a long time and was just unquestioned in largely the South of these currently United States. And let's look a little bit at the history of the Klan. The Klan in the 1860s, of course, rose from the ashes of the North's incredible devastation of the Southern culture, from the anger and nationalistic pride of something called the Redemption Movement, which was a redemption after the occupation by the North of the South under the Reconstruction. Was the spark for the Klan of the 60s the federal imposition, or as they saw it, imposition and enactment of the civil rights laws, which so seemed to threaten their culture and be kind of an occupation?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of direct parallels and very powerful parallels between the 1860s and the 1960s. So the sense that the South was being besieged and being controlled in a very inappropriate way by federal forces, their way of life was being torn apart by the federal government. There were very similar feelings in the 1960s when there was a strong move to preserve what they would refer to as states' rights, just local control over political ideals. And the sense that the federal government didn't care about them. That's something that you hear again and again in Klan circles is, you know, the government does not care about our poor working class white communities in rural eastern North Carolina, let's say. Mm-hmm. What they're focusing on are often urban northern communities, which they saw as really being equivalent to black communities. So you'd get the sense that the federal government not only is inappropriately overstepping its bounds, but it's doing so in the name of other people, and it's not representing their interests anymore. So it's really about the sense of a loss of control in a straightforward political sense.
And I have to say, and this will come up as we discuss this issue over the next 50 minutes or so, some of these sentimentalities that I hear now that you were just describing, feeling like the government doesn't care about me, isn't my government, It sounds like stuff that's still going on in well into the 21st century. Things like the Tea Party and the hard right, which has largely taken over the Republican Party. But I do want to stick, for now anyway, with a bit of the history and definition of the culture that you looked at, the Ku Klux Klan. People know the Klan by their hooded outfits. It's kind of easy to understand. There's a uniform, a sense of belonging, creates terror amongst the others, and a sense of anonymity. What about the cross burning? Can you explain what that's about? It's never really made sense to me.
Well, cross burnings actually first emerged through an image and an act in a movie, of all things. So the movie The Birth of a Nation came out in 1915.
Right.
Portrayed the Klan of the 19th century, and it portrayed the Klan burning a cross. The Klan, as far as we know, in the 1860s, never did burn crosses.
Hmm.
A revived incarnation of the Klan beginning in 1915 and really peaking in the 1920s, where the Klan had several million members nationwide, took on this act of burning crosses. And the way that they saw it was really as a Christian act. You know, one of the things that the Klan in the 1960s did was produce a whole set of records that often would be speeches by leaders, and they had a whole record dedicated to what a burning cross meant. And it was all about spreading the light of Jesus into the countryside. And clearly there was another side to it, which was about political terror, but it was framed in a very overtly religious way, and it was seen as spreading Christianity. In a white supremacist version, of course, but it was really about spreading that kind of image through rallies and through using these crosses in communities as well.
Yeah, we've seen that before, spreading religion, whether people like it or not. It's going to be stuck on it. If you just tuned in, we're talking with David Cunningham, the author of the new book, Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era, Ku Klux Klan. And there were at least three phases of the Klan, as described in the book. There were the 1860s, the 1920s, and the 60s. And certainly the context of the 1920s was the pervasiveness of nativism, a sense of diminution of the status of Protestant whites. And I wonder how much the rise of the Klan was a sense of reacting to humiliations from the outside, seeking for restoration of some sense of valor and manliness. Is that consistent throughout all the phases? How much of a factor in the appeal of the Klan is a sense of manliness under attack? And segregation has been framed as a defense of the family. So I wonder about that sense of manliness and humiliation and reaction to that.
Yeah, I find it really interesting the way that you're framing it here, because one of the themes of white supremacy, especially its form in the American South, is really often about the preservation of the purity of white womanhood. But what that really means is it's defining white men's roles to defend white women. So really, a group like the Klan, which by definition was restricted to men in terms of membership, was really about men standing up as white men and defending white womanhood, which is seen as being threatened by all these things that you're mentioning, the sense of nativism, the sense of a devaluation of their place in society. So manhood is really inextricably bound up in that. And how members would be recruited often was an explicit appeal to manhood. The Klan had a whole series of bumper stickers by the 1960s, and the best-selling bumper sticker for years was always just simply said, "Be a man, join the Klan." And it really spoke to that broader ideal of what white manhood meant in this political context.
And as you said, ladies were not permitted to join the Klan, but there was a ladies' auxiliary always there. And I'm going to play a cut now by one of the speakers of the ladies' auxiliary. He talks exactly to the point that you were just making.
Sybil Jones.
Ladies, the women in this county, the women in this town need your help and they need your support. Your husband have a job, you expect him to go out and make a living. Then it's no more than right for you to help him. Do you know, as I have said many, many times from a platform, You know that in Russia, the people live behind an iron curtain. But then, let me tell you, I really feel sorry for you, because I know a lot of you men who live behind one little iron petticoat, and it's pathetic. Men, why don't you step out from behind it and be a man? Women, you don't know how good you would feel if your husband was a man that could stand on his own two feet and not have to ask you every time he went to the 50-yard dash behind the house. You really would. So women, they need you. They need your support today. As I said, tomorrow could be too late. Today is the day.
Wow, powerful stuff there. And, you know, this it always amazes me how proving you're a man, sense of manliness, if you look at it throughout history, how much damage that has caused to the world. And certainly, and I look back to the so-called Scottsboro boys, when these women on a train were allegedly raped, and to protect their honor, they named these, I believe it was 8 or 9 black men who were on the train with them. And of course, these men were jailed for a long time, and until they were, of course, found innocent. But that sense of manliness, it's really interesting to me. David, anything to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I would totally agree with what you're saying. And that speech that we just heard was by a woman named Sybil Jones, who is the wife of, who's referred to as the Grand Dragon, right, in North Carolina. The Grand Dragon would just be the state leader in Klan terms. And Sybil Jones would speak at most rallies in the 1960s. And these rallies could have, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people at them. Right. So they were large-scale events. And she was doing exactly what you're describing, where she ostensibly is speaking to the women in the crowd. You know, she's trying to recruit people to join these ladies' auxiliary units that are providing support for the Klan. But who she's really speaking to, and who she's addressing, and who she's posing a very strong challenge to, are the men in the crowd, which is that, you know, if you're a real man, you're going to support women, defend women, and women will know what it's like to be with a real man. So she's doing this in a recruiting sense, this really brilliant kind of turn, where she's challenging the men in the crowd to be men and to join the Klan. And, you know, it was a very effective appeal in this particular case. And you're right, it's something that almost by definition creates an adversarial, sure, and very militant tone to what people are doing here.
And certainly for the Great War, which is now known as the First World War, proving you were a man was a big part of how they got so many people to fight in Britain and in Germany and France and on and on and on.
You're entirely right. And what you see is after World War I is when the Klan's membership really takes off. So it's when people have come home. And you're right, there's that already that environment that's primed for this. And when you combine it with various economic shifts and fear of waves of immigrants coming into the country, right, it was very easy to take those sentiments and twist them in a way that really worked towards the Klan's ends.
One thing you point out, you talk about, you know, having a sense of solidarity and manliness. The Klan was called by one journalist described in your book, Klansville, USA, a poor man's fraternal lodge, a rural trade union, an economic cooperative. The Catholics have their Knights of Columbus, Jews have B'nai B'rith, Negroes, the NAACP. We have the Klan. A sense of belonging. Bob Jones, as you talked about, one of the main characters here, the Grand Dragon, he said, everybody's organized except the white Protestant. So the KKK sought to present itself as the only group that truly represented the interests of patriotic white Protestants. And Robert Shelton, another big Klan member, is quoted, said, it's all about patriotism to maintain the liberty bequeathed to us by our forefathers, and to preserve the American way of life. David, do you hear anything like that being said today?
I think that is a theme that endures. It certainly preceded the Klan, and it can extend beyond the Klan. That at one level, this idea that white Anglo-Saxon Protestants are not being represented in, you know, by the kinds of organizations like the NAACP might represent African-Americans and so on, is patently ridiculous, in the sense that mainstream institutions and elite institutions tend to be way disproportionately representing that sort of group. So certainly somebody like Robert Shelton or Bob Jones is neglecting the fact that they're controlling, you know, the group that they're addressing is controlling almost everything in terms of local governments, state governments, et cetera. But in an environment where people feel besieged, you feel like that's going away. And then you say, well, who's really protecting us? We've just taken it for granted that this is our way of life. And, you know, I think this is something that you entirely see today. We certainly have a very shaky economy over the last few years. There are a lot of changes. There's a lot of talk about immigrants. And these kind of issues, when combined with an African-American president, where there's a lot of distrust in a lot of these kinds of white conservative communities, you really see it becoming fodder for mobilization in a way that isn't entirely different from what you would have seen in the 1960s or the 1920s or the 1860s.
Yeah, I know. It's very interesting. And one thing I've learned, you know, the one thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history. Again, we're talking with the author of Klansville, USA, David Cunningham, and the book focuses on the Klan in North Carolina specifically. Interesting. It was thought of at the time as a moderate, even liberal, progressive state compared to the Deep South. As you say, the United Klan of America's presence in North Carolina eclipsed Klan membership in all other Southern states combined. And you say that the political leader's moderate orientation to civil rights could paradoxically broaden the appeal of the Klan. And you also say that the civil rights movement, in a way, was a Klan recruiting agent. You say that the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Martin Luther King and so many others, and the Klan engaged in sort of an interactive dance. How did this dynamic play itself out in North Carolina?
Well, North Carolina, as you're saying, was very well known for being moderate, or what they refer to as progressive, in terms of race relations. And so what was very clear in North Carolina was that it was politically conservative in terms of race, meaning you would never have a political official proclaiming immediate desegregation as a good thing, something that they're in favor of. Right. However, what they were clear about is that they would abide by federal law. So it was clear that if the Civil Rights Act was passed, which it was in the summer of 1964, North Carolina would desegregate. And certainly that took a long time, but there wasn't militant defiance from governors, et cetera, that you would have seen in places like Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. And so what that created was an environment where people couldn't be confident that their political representatives would defend their way of life. So in a place like Mississippi, you'd see an affirmed segregationist could count on their governor standing in schoolhouse doors,
right,
could count on their mayor passing ordinances to prevent civil rights mobilization, could count on their school boards to expel students whose parents joined the NAACP, and so on. And so the Klan filled a very narrow niche in that setting. These are people in a place like Mississippi that thought that violence was the only answer. So they would choose the Klan over all of these other segregationist outlets. In North Carolina, those other outlets didn't exist in the same way. So the Klan framed itself as filling that whole spectrum of committed commitment to segregation. And that interacted with, as you're saying, the growth of a very vibrant civil rights movement in North Carolina. So beyond this overall political environment, where groups like the NAACP, the SCLC, which were the two major civil rights organizations in North Carolina through the 1960s, where they were active and increasing their actions, that's where you'd see the Klan organizing in reaction to that. And sort of, you know, they'd have a rally that would combat an NAACP march and so on, and you'd see that kind of dance going back and forth.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You described some situations where policing forces, various local police, or in North Carolina, there was the State Bureau of Investigation, which focused on the civil rights activists as, quote, the root cause of racial strife, unquote. I think that's just fascinating. So they would go in there, the State Bureau of Investigation would, you know, if there was a conflict between the Klan and the civil rights people, the cause of it, obviously, was the civil rights people. Was that pretty accurate?
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. There was this there was this lip service to being very balanced. So they would, in a very dedicated way, both the State Bureau of Investigation, the State Highway Patrol, and also FBI agents would monitor the Klan pretty closely. So they'd have their agents at nearly every rally. The State Highway Patrol would be directing traffic and things like that. But they would be monitoring these rallies, and they're trying to prevent violence.
Right.
But the underlying ethic was this idea that even though we're being balanced, and the Klan are extremists in the same way the NAACP is extremist, that would be the policing line there, there was a clear bias towards thinking that the real rabble-rousers were the NAACP and other civil rights groups. And the Klan wouldn't be necessary if these other groups weren't organizing. So they really saw the Klan as reacting to the rabble-rousing on the other side, and it created a huge political and policing bias as we moved through the 60s.
It's interesting. And, you know, you talk about something that there was real pride in, the North Carolina way. I wonder what that meant. You know, it was appearing moderate, not, you know, facing down the federal legislation like the other southern states, Mississippi, Alabama, and others. But in the North Carolina way, was there not a clear, understood hierarchy of races that was just simply part of the North Carolina way?
It was this idea that North Carolina was not, it was explicitly saying North Carolina is not the Deep South, meaning,
right.
and this was largely tied into an appeal to Northern industry, getting people to move to North Carolina, saying that this is a very progressive place. We're not brutal in terms of race relations. We believe in people eventually being equal. So it was this very gradualist rhetoric about we are willing to move forward and desegregate, but it's going to take time. But what that really tied into is exactly how you're saying, this idea of racial hierarchy is a very pronounced paternalism towards African Americans, which is political officials who were uniformly white, of course, through this period, saying, we know what's best for you, and you need to listen to us in terms of the pacing of change, in terms of the limits of change, in terms of how it will take place. And there was really a strong effort to speak in high-minded rhetoric about racial egalitarianism while there was a very pronounced racial paternalism going on in terms of who was making the decisions and who really had the kind of freedom and autonomy to control their own political, economic, and social destinies.
And then there was something called the Good Neighbor Councils. I wonder if that was, am I right to see that as a rubber stamp for the power structure? And I wonder if they could be said to be, I mean, in that they were interested in preserving white supremacy, were they sort of a softer, gentler, sublimated Klan, these Good Neighbor Councils?
Well, Good Neighbor Councils were formed by a governor named Terry Sanford in the early 1960s. And what he was trying to do is create biracial bodies in nearly every significant community in North Carolina. So he would promote these as local initiatives. And, you know, his idea was that if there are racial grievances and racial conflicts, there was no biracial body that could mediate these kinds of things. And so what he thought was that these good neighbor councils could be there to deal with any racial tensions that emerged in a way that both sides, both white residents and black residents, felt like their interests were being represented. The underlying policy thrust of good neighbor councils were to work towards a more integrated workforce. And the rhetoric of the economic goals here were really that there are skills in the African-American community that are being underexploited, and therefore North Carolina's economy is being held back by strict patterns of segregation. But what they were really asking are employers to voluntarily and in a very limited way integrate their workforces. But the Good Neighbor Councils had no ability to enforce anything. All that they were doing is making suggestions to employers and to residents and being there at really symbolically as a biracial body.
And I wonder if part of the goal was to let off the steam and to reduce the potential violence while still maintaining the power structure and the institutions that there are.
Exactly. I think that's exactly how that played out, in the sense that they were treated as a pressure valve. You know, you could go speak to the Good Neighbor Council if there were some sort of tensions, and it would absorb those kinds of things. And since it wasn't moving forward in any tangible way to change things in terms of race relations, I think you're right that it really did become an affirmation of the status quo.
Fascinating. And the book cover, you really should look at it. The back cover, I actually saw one of these billboards. It says, you are in the heart of Klan country. Welcome to North Carolina. Join the United Klans of America. Help fight integration and communism. And it has a picture of a knight rider on a horse with the flaming cross. I believe I saw that in 1972 when I crossed over into North Carolina. Very kind of chilling. And the cover has a street walk. And I'm not sure if that cover is in North Carolina or if that's in some other place. I wonder if you could describe the purpose of the street walk.
Sure. And the photo that is on the cover is from Salisbury, North Carolina, which is just a bit north of Charlotte. And so what these street walks were is the Klan in North Carolina would have rallies somewhere in the state most nights of the year. So they would organize these nightly rallies. And prior to many of these rallies, they would have members gather in the late afternoon down the main street of the county seat, usually, so the largest community in the county, and they would march, and typically there'd be 100 to 200 members that would participate, and they would march right down Main Street. They would be wearing their robes, their regalia, their faces would be showing. They would be encouraged to bring their family, so you'd see women from the Ladies Auxiliary Unit, you'd see lots of kids. And they would march down, and the idea was to create a proud public presence for the Klan and say, we're not hiding under sheets under the dark of night. We're marching down your main street at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it became quite a spectacle, and it was something that was very effective to create this public presence.
And I wonder how, you know, if this indicates that there was fairly widespread acceptance, whether you completely agree with it or not, of the Klan in North Carolina. And there's this intersection of politics and culture. And I want to, there's a song here. Part of culture, of course, is music. And I should warn listeners, it is going to be offensive. Guaranteed, this is going to be offensive. But this was part of their rally that is talked about in the book, that they had these rallies, the Klan rallies. And there was this group called Skeeter Bob and the Country Pals. And again, don't be shocked. I warned you, okay? Here it comes.
Move them niggas north, move them niggas north. If they don't like our southern ways, move them niggas north. Our south has been invaded by tragedy looking food. They'll change our ways and take our schools away from me and you. It's time for us to make a stand to keep our southern ways. We've got to give a helping hand. It's unity that pays. Move them niggas north, move them niggas north. If they don't like our southern ways, move them niggas north.
And it goes on. It's not a word I'm comfortable hearing anymore these days, but that was from the era. We're looking at a little bit of history here. So, you know, here is this, there, it seems, I'm guessing, and correct me if I'm wrong here, this Skeeter Bob and his Country Pals were perhaps reflecting the dominant culture and the fear that people felt. What can you say about that, David?
Well, I think in some ways that's definitely true. I mean, it was certainly a distorted version of the dominant culture, but the underlying values had very widespread appeal. So the majority of white North Carolinians during this period would not be joining the KKK, even though the Carolina Klan was very large. But, you know, if you look at anything from public opinion polls to newspaper editorials to anything, you'd see that the vast majority of white North Carolinians and white Southerners supported the maintenance of Jim Crow segregation through the 1960s. And that tide doesn't turn really until the late 60s into the 70s, even in things like public opinion polls. So this ideal, which is preserving a way of life and also indicting the federal government. So the whole idea of moving, I'll say moving African Americans north, is really about, you know, this is, it's easy for you to say that we should integrate. You're not living in our communities. And so if we move our, a quote-unquote racial problem up your direction, see how you deal with it. So it was really, in some ways, expressing resentment towards the federal government, which was a widespread sentiment, certainly. You see tons of critique of the federal government throughout the 1960s, but also this underlying affirmation of Jim Crow, of segregation, of white supremacy.
Yeah, underlying affirmation. As you said, the United Clans of America, which was the biggest Klan group, clearly, the UKA did not construct its blend of racist, anti-Semitic, and anti-communist thought out of whole cloth. My understanding was, for example, throughout the 19th century, I don't think racism was not even a word. It was so pervasive. Everybody was... you know, even progressives and liberals, it was just taken for granted that, of course, you were racist. And, you know, I remember growing up in the 50s and early 60s and seeing, you know, the racist violence in the South. I thought it was something bizarre and something just limited exclusively to, you know, some dangerous, nasty people, not from around here. But, you know, it's been with us really for a long time. And I think it's fascinating that, as you describe in the book, the Klan saw civil rights as part of a plot by communists and Jews. And as it said on that poster, help fight integration and communism, as part of a plot for communists and Jews to use the race issue, as if African-Americans couldn't do it on their own, to use the race issue as a way to consolidate power and to take power away from the good, authentic, white, you know, Protestant Christian Americans. How important, David Cunningham, was anti-communism in creating the context for the rise of the Klan in the early 60s, the anti-communism of the 1950s? How important was that to the rise of the Klan in the 60s?
Well, like the ideas about race that you were discussing just earlier, this climate of anti-communism was very widespread. So the fear of communist infiltration, certainly through the McCarthy hearings and you know, in the decade prior to this, and in various other aspects of life, you see this very strongly reflected in the FBI's orientation to various political threats. It was an underlying fear that communists were infiltrating all sorts of political institutions. And the way that it intersects with racism in this case is really fascinating, I think, and very important, because it is this idea, as you say, that the civil rights movement, either African-Americans are not capable of what they're accomplishing through the civil rights movement, so there must be somebody else behind it, like communists, like Jews, or the softer version of that is that even if the civil rights movement is being led by the African-American community, they're susceptible and vulnerable to communist influence. So either way, they need to be prevented, not just because of the racial change that they're working towards, but because that racial change could be bound up in the downfall, literally, of a capitalist America. I mean, that's the way it's framed. So you see many Klan leaders. You know, one of the surprising things about these rallies that you'd see that would be held in North Carolina and elsewhere in the South is that there are certain speakers that would speak very little about race, actually. It was taken for granted that segregation was something that they were standing for. What they were trying to instruct and teach the crowd, really, is that this isn't just about segregation. This is about your very way of life politically. You know, so it's this great battle between capitalism and communism, and that was really seen as the underlying framework for the racial political position.
It's amazing to me how we see that nowadays with the number of issues that our American way of life is threatened by this African-American president, calling him a socialist. They want to take away your guns. They want to take away your America. And I definitely want to get to that before the end of the show. And, you know, we talked about policing as a big part of it. As you point out, policing was, frankly, a big part of the end of the Klan in the late 60s, and you never know who the police were for. In fact, in North Carolina and many other places, a lot of the police were members of the Klan, and the State Bureau of Investigation blamed, as we mentioned, the civil rights people as the problem. Now, the FBI was led at the time, of course, by J. Edgar Hoover, who was rabidly anti-communist, as we know. So I'm curious, how is it that the FBI, which shared so many of the values with the Klan, how did they, why did they change and start really cracking down and infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan?
Well, what had happened is in 1964, as many of your listeners will recall or know, three civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi, in Neshoba County, Mississippi. And this was one of the major stories of the entire summer because it took about 2 months for their bodies to be discovered. So the story extended throughout the summer. And Robert Kennedy, the attorney general at the time, came to J. Edgar Hoover and said, and Hoover had always resisted protecting civil rights workers. This was something that Hoover would have been steadfastly against. But Bobby Kennedy comes to him and insists that he needs to do something to prevent this kind of racial violence in the South. And what Hoover does is he proposes that a set of counterintelligence programs that he had run for the past 10 years since 1956 against communist agents, against suspected Communist Workers Party members, Socialist Workers Party members, and so on, could also be applied towards the Klan. And these are programs that really undertook a lot of dirty tricks to neutralize, disrupt, and really try to eliminate their targets. So they were predominantly unconstitutional, engaging in illegal acts by agents. But what Hoover knew was that if this program was approved to target the Klan, he could now import it to deal with domestic threats. It had always been something that it could only be dealing with threats from abroad. And so communist agents were seen as international, global threats. And so his operation against the Klan was really a wedge to later target, ironically, the civil rights movement, to target the anti-war movement, to target campus protest. Right. And so the Klan program became this wedge for the FBI to actually engage in much broader and more widespread surveillance and disruption of domestic political organizations.
And there's certain, I mean, those three workers, was it Cheney, Schwerner, and who was the other one now?
And Andrew Goodman.
Oh, yeah, and Goodman, yeah. They were killed in... The Klan got a lot of attention for being violent, for advocating. Well, I don't know if the Klan actually advocated violence as an organization per se, other than, you know, members, as you described, just doing it kind of on their own. But I wonder if you have a guess as to how many African Americans were in fact killed by the KKK. I'm sure there's no accurate record keeping, but would you venture a guess?
Well, I think, in terms of, it's often difficult to untangle Klan killings from racial killings in various ways. And so if we deal with kind of the world of the Klan, even if it's not formally the Klan, certainly we know of several dozen cases, upwards of 100 cases, throughout the long civil rights movement. And surely there are hundreds of others that have been unsolved, unrecognized. The Klan themselves engaged in probably what we'd know to be somewhere in the order of 15 known killings through this period in the 1960s. But one of the things that you see happening in terms of Klan violence by the second half of the 1960s is it literally goes underground, even within Klan circles. So people are engaging in individual and small cell-like plots to undertake violence against African Americans, often in fairly random ways. And so what Klan people started talking about by 1967 or so is going out knocking. And the idea of knocking is going by yourself in the middle of the night out in these sort of lonely country roads. And if you see, a black man walking along the side of the street, is you could shoot him and drive away. And these crimes would never be investigated because there wouldn't be any evidence. You know, it'd be a single gunshot wound, you know, inevitably no one would have seen it. Inevitably, or oftentimes at least, the police wouldn't be terribly invested in an extensive right. investigation. And you'd see literally hundreds of these articles. They'd be a paragraph on page 14 of a newspaper saying so-and-so was found shot dead with a single gunshot wound. And almost certainly the majority of those killings that were really framed as random were effectively a Klan plot to strike terror into the heart of the black community.
I'm sure that would do it. That and doing other pranks, as you described, such as putting burning crosses in people's lawns. That was real terrorism. And it seems that the FBI must have had to have gone after that as terrorism as well.
Well, eventually they came to, for a long time, and I spoke with several State Bureau of Investigation agents, former agents, who would be very clear that for quite a while in the 1960s, they would sort of look the other way with cross burnings, because they would feel like, oh, they didn't really hurt anybody. You know, it was terrorizing, you know, in a way that they wouldn't take seriously. But since it wasn't an outright explicit act of violence, physical violence, the police really wouldn't take them that seriously. And I found literally hundreds of police reports of crosses being burned on people's lawns, almost none of which led to any sort of conviction, certainly not prior to 1967, and most of which weren't taken very seriously. And policing agents wouldn't really be seeing that as something that they're targeting in terms of their policing of the Klan.
Many years ago in college, I had a professor who defined politics as the economy of violence. You don't necessarily have to use it to know that it's there. So the cross burnings, you know, they were just sort of enforcing what was there. I find it fascinating that, as is often the case with the left, and we're going to talk about the downfall of the Klan in the late 60s, it's so often the case on the left, there's infighting and schisms. Abby Hoffman used to say, isms get schisms and go to wasms pretty quick. From a sociological point of view, what is it about fringe group and that tendency to self-destruct?
Well, I think groups that are, you know, we can say at the margins, but groups that are fringe, that are extremist in various ways, are subject to lots of pressures. You know, they always, like any political group, they want to grow. But growing creates all sorts of tensions because you end up with a broader sort of vision of what the group should be doing. And it often creates all sorts of tensions within the group in terms of what their goals should rightfully be. So growth often creates issues for any group, but when the group has a relatively extremist ideology, that is very difficult to maintain in a cohesive and unified way as the group gets larger. So they're subject to that kind of tension. Oftentimes, though, you see, especially in this period, and I think we could make parallels to today as well, is that the policing of these groups really try to overtly exacerbate these kinds of tensions.
Uh-huh.
And so what the FBI would be doing in the 1960s, not just to the KKK, but to groups that were operating on college campuses in terms of political organization, groups that were protesting the war, various civil rights groups, is they would have literally hundreds of informants, this whole network of informants that weren't just informing, meaning monitoring and providing information. They were operating as provocateurs in various ways. They were trying to create infighting between leaders. And so many of the tensions that you see emerging in the later 1960s, certainly in these kinds of quote-unquote fringe groups, were really created and exacerbated by the police in various ways, especially through their informant development.
It's fascinating to me that in the late 70s, the anti-nuclear movement was growing, and there were thought to be FBI people in there who'd stir up trouble and, you know, create divisions, and it worked pretty well. I'm convinced that that was the reality. It's a good strategy. And the Klan, of course, went largely out of business in the late 60s, early 70s. But in 1968, a guy named Richard Nixon was running for president, and he had something called the Southern Strategy, which it seems to me sought to tap into white anxieties about desegregation policies and intentionally channeled Klan-type sentiment into an institutionalized outlet known as the Republican Party. Did it work? Am I reading that right?
I think you are reading it right. I mean, certainly there was this explicit Southern strategy, and, you know, so what what had happened in terms of politics during this period, as many of your listeners will recall, is that not only did you have a battle between Democrats, so the South had been solidly Democratic for decades, and Republicans, you also had third-party candidates, and George Wallace was the best known of them, who were explicitly trying to tap into that segregationist constituency. And there was a recognition, especially among Republicans, that the Wallace constituency could be claimed, not by echoing the overtly racist positions that Wallace would have been prone to make, certainly in 1968, but by appealing to that in other kinds of ways, focusing on law and order, focusing on crime, focusing on local control of political directions. All of these things were speaking to states' rights, speaking to segregationist positions. So certainly Nixon was able to tap into it through that way. He was also able to tap into the sentiment by really appealing to the fact that the South by the late 60s was changing quite a bit. If you think of the Sunbelt South, it was growing tremendously, and middle-class suburban communities were growing tremendously. And so what you saw was that they would also be attracted to not just this sort of coded racial positions that the Republicans would take, but also their economically conservative positions. So that these sort of growing affluent suburban communities looked a lot like communities in the Midwest, et cetera, and they would vote for Nixon in the same way as people in other parts of the country would as well. One of the things that I found in a study with my colleague Rory McVeigh is that Republican voting in the South was most pronounced in counties where the Klan was active. And that's a more complicated story than it sounds. It's not that Klan members were voting for Republicans, although that happened as well. But what the Klan really did in a lot of these communities was to help to untether people from voting Democratic. Because there are a lot of longstanding Democratic loyalties and allegiances. And what the Klan always said was not that you should vote Republican, but rather that you shouldn't vote for people that don't support your position and your way of life, regardless of what party they're from. So it loosened people's allegiances to the Democrats. And then when Nixon and then later Reagan come in with the Southern strategy, it was much easier for them to tap into those voters who had been untethered, in effect, by the Klan in the 1960s.
Again, we're talking on the Burt Cohen Show with David Cunningham, author of the powerful new book, Klansville, USA. And certainly the civil rights era Klan has fallen, but you say its legacy endures in surprising ways. And I have to say, I look at the right wing of the 20-teens, and there's a sense of anti-elitism. They want to talk about, I see a line like this from the Klan that the dual pillars of the Constitution and the Bible. The Klan line was that true Christians have an obligation to organize to oppose civil rights policies. Now you could say just replace the word civil rights policies with guns, gays, and abortion. As you said, one of the strengths of the Klan was its appeal in its function as an alternative institution for disaffected white workers and their families. You also point out that weapons were a central part of the Clavern, that's the local Klan clubs, the Clavern culture. There's the NRA. They feel like they're under attack. They certainly have a high value on the centrality of their weapons. It's not overtly racist like it used to be. They certainly use, you know, racist lines from time to time. But the sense of, you know, the government isn't serving us, the, you know, working class white people, the right wing populism. I'm getting a sense that some of that sentiment and some of the strength of what the Ku Klux Klan talked about, that was a vehicle for some of the similar words that we're hearing today. What do you think, David?
Certainly, I think that's right in a lot of ways. You know, one thing that you can say is that, as you're describing, there is a strain of conservative thought that is really about personal autonomy, the minimization, a deep distrust of what government will do if given power, if given resources, if given control. And, you'll see a whole spectrum of conservative groups that can tie into an anti-government sentiment that comes from that. And the flavor that that takes is really conditioned, I think, by the kind of perceived threat that's out there at any given time. So certainly race overtakes all sorts of things in the South in the 1960s. Race is still salient and relevant today, so it's part of the story, but there's also various other things. And so certainly gun control is right on the tip of everyone's tongue these days. And, you know, I know the Southern Poverty Law Center just released a report a week or two ago about the huge spike in pro-gun militia groups and otherwise that have really blossomed in the wake of gun control legislative efforts and all of that. And so, you know, but underlying all of that, it's not to say that the Klan is the Tea Party or the Klan is a new version of a militia group or a previous version of a militia group, but they're tapping into the same kind of conservative, often anti-government sentiment. And the way in which they tap in are going to be really conditioned by the times. But that stream of thought is something that has really flown, has threaded through American history. So it predated the Klan. It certainly has outlasted the Klan in other ways. But you can see the Klan's legacy as bound up in those kinds of appeals to personal autonomy and to keeping government out of people's lives.
Certainly. And right now, where we are in history, it's fascinating to me, the timing of this discussion. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering doing away with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which has been called the most important civil rights legislation that we've ever had. Section 5 is at the heart of the landmark law that made civil rights legislation happen. If it is repealed, as it may well be, because we have some real right-wing judges on the U.S. Supreme Court, do you think that could mean a rise of overt racism? And I wonder how the remnants of the Klan are feeling about it now, because it has to do with gerrymandering district and voter registration and keeping it under local control, wink, wink.
Well, certainly anything that can sort of loosen constraints on the suppression of voting, which is exactly what the Voting Rights Act is trying to prevent, poses a significant risk. And you see such a strong legacy in struggles in the 1960s in communities, not just in the South, but certainly the South is a place where you see this being very concentrated. You certainly see a very straight line in terms of voting patterns to struggles in the 60s to what you still often see today. And to the extent that we've had progress in these ways, you can see the Voting Rights Act as being perhaps the most successful piece of legislation that we've had in the last half century. So any changes that we have seen in terms of a more inclusive democracy in the districts that it covers can largely be seen as a credit to the act itself rather than evidence that the act is no longer necessary. I think we have many good reasons to be wary of the act disappearing and just thinking that we won't fall back into older patterns and really entrenched patterns of controlling the electorate in various ways through the suppression of voting.
It is amazing how, you know, history goes on and it doesn't change that much. There's a lot more I'd like to talk about. We need to, I'd like to leave it with, as you certainly agree, truth and reconciliation is a big part of it. We got to learn from and not repeat the context which gave rise to groups like the Klan. Powerful book, fascinating book, amazing part of our history, a great perspective from which to look at it, the sociological perspective. I highly recommend it. Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era, Ku Klux Klan, the author David Cunningham. Thanks so much for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Good. He guards your neighborhood. every now and then, someone breaks into the promised land.